there will be at least three main drivers for the migration year 2025. The ongoing war in Ukraine, the developments in Syria, and the new government in the United States. All of them could have a dramatic impact on Europe. ICMBD's Migration Outlook report looks into the future of migration and describes the most important trends, origins, key events, and priorities for Europe. Today, I have the great pleasure of welcoming Martin Hoffmann, the lead author of the Migration Outlook and ICMBD's Principal Advisor. A very warm welcome, Martin.
Thank you, Bernhard, for having me.
At the heart of the ICMBD Migration Outlook, there are 10 migration issues to look out for. I want to discuss the most important ones with you. Currently, Donald Trump's presidency is at the center of public interest. ICMBD has a focus on migration in the European context. For this reason, I would like to start our discussion not with the USA. I want to start with the country from which the largest number of refugees has come to Europe since the Second World War. I want to start with Ukraine. Martin, you recommend preparing for different outcomes of the war in Ukraine. What possible scenarios do you have in mind, and what do they mean in terms of migration?
I have to apologize that I still have to start shortly with the inauguration of the second term of President Donald Trump, because the question of whether the new US administration will support Ukraine in military, financial, political terms or not will be also decisive for the migration scenarios. And depending on this, there are different scenarios for the further development of the conflict in 2025. The first one is that nothing much changes, a prolonged war of attrition as we face it today or have faced it in previous years. A frozen conflict, an armistice, a ceasefire, most probably not to the advantage of Ukraine in territorial and political terms. A Ukrainian victory and a Ukrainian defeat. Now, we are not an organization that should judge how the conflict might evolve in 2025, but the experts that do basically assume that Ukrainian victory, a complete Ukrainian defeat, are not very likely. So it will be rather a prolonged war or a frozen conflict. And depending on which of those scenarios materialize, there are also different scenarios for migration and displacement, ranging in a positive development from 1 to 2 million returns to Ukraine to, in case of a Ukrainian defeat and more or less dissolution of the Ukrainian state, a further wave of displacement and refugees between 10 and even 19 millions. And those are very thorough and well-designed scenarios. And we can hope for the best in Europe, but we should prepare also for such extreme scenarios.
So there's another main topic in the migration policy debate on Ukraine, which is about the Temporary Protection Directive for Ukraine refugees in the European Union. So what is your take on this debate, and what do you think, how will this debate develop in course of this year?
The Temporary Protection Directive, as it was enacted when the war started, is a very specific legal instrument in the EU that provides protection for people based not on an assessment of the individual case, but based on nationality or belonging to a certain group. And in case of the Ukrainians, also provided them with direct access to EU labor markets. However, temporary already tells us it should be temporary and it should not be endless. So the concept is that when the situation betters, people should return to their home country. And now this has not materialized. Formally speaking, or when we look at the agreement within the EU, this specific instrument should come to an end next year in 2026. And since it was enacted, since it was started, there was also the discussion about the possible exit strategy, what should happen with the more than 4 million Ukrainian beneficiaries of temporary protection in the EU. And this discussion will continue, and it's very difficult to find here a balance between the interests of the EU member states, the interests of the beneficiaries, so that their status changes into long-term resident status, not linked to a protection status anymore. But then there's a strong interest of Ukraine that the people return, as the young, well-educated, largely female population, that this population returns to Ukraine, and because it's absolutely essential for reconstruction and economic development. And to find a balance there is not easy. So I assume that next year the debate will continue, but it's also likely that this kind of situation that we have now will continue also into 2026.
Yeah, there's one other topic related to Ukraine, which you already mentioned. It's about the labor integration of Ukraine refugees in the European Union. So what is the status here at the moment, and what developments do you expect?
When the war started and when there was this massive wave of Ukrainian refugees coming to the EU, there were highly optimistic expectations in terms of the labor market integration of these people, young, well-educated, cultural proximity. So in the public debate, everybody expected they would immediately find jobs on labor markets that anyhow have an increasing structural demand for labor force. Experts and researchers were more cautious. They thought this might take a little longer, like with other refugee populations or cohorts before. And they were right. So then in the public debate, there was a lot of skepticism. Does this really work or not? But last year we have seen, as expected by the experts, that now this labor market integration widely in the major host countries in the EU had a certain takeoff. And now for a well-educated group where normally taking up work takes a bit longer, because it takes a bit longer to find jobs that somehow match their qualifications, the results, the outcomes are rather positive. And this also means, will our economies, our employers want to let go of these people? Will these people want to return now they have managed to establish themselves? And when we look at the figures, the new permits and temporary protection, we already saw last year a certain tendency that they become more male and less female, which also indicates that family decisions go in the direction that families or couples decide, okay, we will either stay or reunite in Ukraine, or we will stay and reunite in the EU. And this is a trend that will continue and most likely also intensify in 2025.
So thank you for these insights on Ukraine. And I would now like to turn to a different country. I would like to turn to Syria. Here again, you describe various scenarios. And here again, these scenarios could lead to very different migration flows. Can you please explain these developments in more details?
Well, first of all, the fall of the Assad regime in Syria was a classical black swan event. Black swan defined by that it has a major impact, but nobody expects it. And that was exactly what happened. So nobody had this, would say, on their bingo card, if you want to call it like that, that the Assad regime would really fall. Now, Syria is a specific case, as we all know, with the civil war in Syria, and then with the big wave of displacement also across borders, the so-called refugee crisis of 2015 started. And this refugee crisis not only changed migration realities, but it also changed the course of at least European migration governance. So there's a high symbolic value or high symbolic aspect of this situation as well. In terms of migration and displacement, the situation was already quite volatile last year. So it was a situation where many people returned to Syria. At the same time, many people had to flee Syria as the Gaza conflict somehow also spilled over into Lebanon. There were Lebanese nationals fleeing to Syria and back. UNHCR speaks about an additional million of displaced last year, but also plans for this year with a figure of a return of a million. And since the fall of the Assad regime, already 200,000 people within 2 months have returned to Syria. So we see a volatile situation, and how this will develop in the long run, but also next year, will highly depend on the political situation and the security situation in the first place. The Syrian government wants their citizens back. They have very clearly declared that they need the people for reconstruction. Syrian refugees themselves, to a larger degree than other refugee populations, also want back. And of course, the European host countries and Turkey as the most important host country also have an interest. So there is a constellation that would allow for a return, a large-scale return. But the question is, will it be really feasible given the situation on the ground?
Let's take a closer look at the main migration policy issue, at the issue of return. So in our press release on this year's Migration Outlook, we had a corresponding quote from our Director General, Michael Spinnerlecker. He emphasizes that return follows reconstruction and points out how important it is to invest in the reconstruction of the necessary infrastructure. So how do you see the issue of return and the related debates in this context?
To start with, Syria has experienced more than 10 years of an immensely devastating civil war. Apart from the enormous human toll, the economic and humanitarian situation is extremely dire as well. It is catastrophic. To give you only a few examples, the Syrian economy has more than halved since 2015. 70% of the population live in poverty, 25% in extreme poverty. So the political will, as I've said, on side of the new Syrian government is there. They want the people back. And also the people want back. But it will be very much dependent on the practical feasibility of return. You have to have something to return to. And when this is not the case, then return will be practically impossible. So alongside a peaceful and inclusive political development, successful reconstruction will be necessary to recreate the conditions for large-scale return. So it would be advisable for the international community, but also in particularly for the countries hosting the largest Syrian refugee populations, Turkey, Lebanon, Germany, Jordan, Iraq, Egypt, Austria, Sweden, and the Netherlands, to work very closely on that. And when you go through this list again, you will see that it is basically Turkey and the European Union host countries that have the financial means to really seriously engage in this reconstruction. And they should do it when they have an interest that large-scale return is really possible.
Now let's zoom out and take a look at the big picture. Your first migration issue to look out for describes a phenomenon that last occurred in 2015. Global migration trends and migration to Europe are decoupled again. While global migration is increasing, migration to Europe is falling. So how do you explain this, and how will it continue to develop?
Since many years, there was, and of course there still is, a link between the global numbers of forcibly displaced within and across borders and the number of irregular arrivals and asylum seekers in Europe, in the EU. And just like in other safe destinations like Turkey, USA, and so on and so forth. Last year, again, the number of globally displaced grew for the 13th time in a row by another 12% to another to about 126 million. However, both the number of irregular arrivals in the EU and the number of asylum applications saw a decrease compared to 2023. A very distinct decrease when it comes to irregular arrivals, minus 40%, but also more than minus 10% in terms of asylum applications. So the total figures, when we look at those two main indicators of this connection between global displacement and the figures in Europe, these two figures are still quite high, but the decrease is also quite significant. Why was this the case? I think that last year there was a very pronounced global trend towards more restrictive migration policies. Many destination countries, not only the European ones or the ones of the so-called global north, but many other destination countries as well, implemented measures to hinder physical access to their territories, facilitate the repatriation, deportation of undocumented populations, build walls and fences, and introduced also legal changes that would make it harder for asylum seekers or refugees to exit the territory or to reside on the territory. This was the case in 2024, and this will continue in 2025. And such examples you find in Latin American countries, in Brazil, Panama, Mexico. You find them in North African countries, in Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia. You find them in Turkey. You find them in Iran. You find them in Pakistan. And of course, similar plans have also been announced by the incoming U.S. government, and yesterday the president started immediately with trying to implement those programs that are all restrictive, to add that footnote. Meanwhile, the EU also intends to focus on the externalization of asylum processing and on maybe also the externalization of return procedures, but definitely on improving return measures as a whole. And all these measures and all these policies had the impact on the figures in Europe. The big question now is, of course, will that be sustainable? Is it transactional? Is it transformational? When we take into account that the root causes for displacement have not been addressed and global displacement is increasing and will also increase next year.
So I didn't ask for a question related to the US, but nevertheless, you mentioned the new president already twice. And of course, his second presidency will have a significant impact on Europe. In this context, you point out the interaction between the migration policy stance of the USA and the migration flows from Latin America. And here you make a very clear prediction. So can you please describe this in more detail? Can you expand on this prediction?
Yeah, you can hold me accountable for this prediction next year. And the prediction is that migration flows from Latin American countries, from the USA in this regard, will be at least partly diverted to Europe. I think I'm pretty much on the safe side saying this, because in recent years, the number of asylum applications submitted by Latin American nationals represented a significant share of the overall applications and a constantly growing share of those applications. And when President Trump took office the first time, there was really a jump in these statistics in the following year. However, the figures did not go down under the Biden administration, first of all, because also the Biden policy was not that much less restrictive, but also because there are other factors coming into play. An important one is, of course, the very liberal visa policy of the EU towards Latin American nationals. Last year, Venezuela, Colombia and Peru all ranked among the top 10 of asylum applications in the EU. Venezuela was third in those statistics. So I think we can really expect that now the US policy will become much more restrictive, that we see an increase of arrivals and of asylum applications from those countries.
So there's another point that you predict related to the second Trump administration. You predict a major change in the general political debate, not only in the USA, but also in Europe. So how does this change of debate look like, and what consequences will this change of debate have?
The success, electoral success of Donald Trump was largely based on the promise of a very strict migration policy. And we see it already. He will try to live up to this promise. And the policy or the policy mix will include a number of measures ranging from the termination of humanitarian protection programs, termination of birthright citizenship, termination of programs also for seasonal low-skilled works. Already yesterday it was announced that the US would at least for the moment not accept any appointments for discussing a possible need for asylum or protection anymore. And one of the promises also was to enact large-scale deportations of undocumented migrants from the US to their mainly Latin American home countries. Now, also for Donald Trump, it would be extremely difficult to really fulfill those promises. But we can assume that at least a few of highly visible deportations will take place. Another question in Europe will be, why don't we do the same? And the European Union, the European states in general have followed the last couple of years a policy that was strongly based on a partnership approach towards non-European countries of transit or origin, and deemed this approach rather successful. We can expect that Donald Trump will not necessarily follow a partnership approach, which was also applied by the previous administration, but will rather try to use force or use other policies to motivate Latin American countries to take back their citizens. So, and this, I think, will be part also of the European debate if this approach is successful and if the images are there that large-scale deportations actually do take place. The question will be, why don't we do it in Europe, as I've said before? And this might also lead to a situation where this nuanced, well-balanced, comprehensive, and strongly based on a principle of partnership with non-European partners policy approach comes under pressure.
So based on these new debates and based on this new on this change in the political debate, you see also an in-depth discussion about, as you call it, innovative solutions. So what solutions do you have in mind, and what significance will these solutions have for Europe?
It's not so much that I have those innovative solutions in mind, but it is what was discussed and will be discussed in the framework, in the context of EU migration policy, as innovative solutions. And as you have rightly said, the topic is return. So most of the so-called innovative solutions refer to either return or the externalization of asylum processing and the externalization of return procedures. Externalization means that the actual asylum procedure of an individual that submits an application in the EU is not processed on the territory of an EU member state, but outside of that. So that's the principal concept. The idea is that such a policy might actually deter people from coming in the first place. I think we have to be honest. And we had two major initiatives last year, the so-called Rwanda initiative by the UK, which was discontinued from a certain point on, and the so-called Italy-Albania memorandum, where applicants intercepted by Italy at sea, when they fall under certain categories, their application should be processed in Albania. And also this plan encountered a number of legal and practical obstacles, so it's not fully operational yet, but the Italian government is very committed and piece by piece tries to overcome those obstacles. And I think it's not unlikely that at a limited scale this will actually become operational next year. And that's the role model for externalization and innovative solutions. So if we see, so to speak, success in this respect, there will be bilateral initiatives going in that direction, and there will be also a strong consensus among the EU member states to sincerely follow the concept of externalization, both on asylum and on return, also from a joint EU side, particularly after a German election, where we can expect that this position for the first time will be also now strongly followed by Germany. So those would be the innovative solutions, and this will be the focus. Again, return and externalization.
Yeah, thank you. And now I would like, after having discussed some of the most important migration issues to look out for, I would like to turn to another chapter of your report. This is the chapter on focus regions. Altogether, you are mentioning 10 focus regions, and I would like to pick out just one of them. I would like to talk about North Africa, and in particular, Algeria, Egypt, Morocco, and Tunisia. So why are these countries a focus region for you, and why? What significance do they have for Europe?
First of all, the European situation has always been closely linked to the situation and the developments in this very region and in the countries that you have mentioned. What is notable, I think, is the role of these countries and how much it has changed in recent years. So they used to be either countries of origin, but more importantly, transit countries of migrants, refugees, asylum seekers coming from other world regions. But they have also developed to important destinations. They have very large populations of mixed migrant groups on the territory, ranging from labor migrants, legal migrants, to undocumented migrants and refugees. And this has led to a situation where they follow very similar approaches then as the EU. As I've mentioned before, also trying to control related flows, which is a maybe nicer term for trying to prevent those flows from happening. And this also has been done in cooperation with the EU and in the framework of meanwhile, quite a number of either EU agreements with those countries or bilateral agreements between EU member states and those countries that carry a strong control aspect, but also at least careful openings when it comes to labor migration, and always components also on economic cooperation and development, so what we call these comprehensive migration partnerships. So last year, the policies that they have implemented, as far as I'm concerned, were one of the main reasons why the number of arrivals, particularly along the so-called Central Mediterranean route from Libya to Italy and also Greece have decreased so much by 60% in case of Italy. Also an effect of Italy-Albania memorandum I have mentioned before, but I think mainly also a result of the policies of the North African countries. And they will try to continue these policies. They also have announced again for this year large-scale expulsion programs for undocumented populations. At the same time, already last autumn, it became clear that the worsening of the security situation further south in the Sahel, sub-Saharan Africa, has led to an increase of arrivals of refugees, for instance, in Tunisia. And so we will have to see to which extent this continues during the year and to which extent the situation in the North African countries becomes more difficult. So again, it's important to watch the developments closely and also keep the focus on cooperation with those countries high. And it's not just about prevention. There were also, I think, very positive policies with regard to fostering voluntary and dignified return. So I think the close cooperation or the closer cooperation between the EU and those countries has delivered in certain areas. It will be continued. But again, it's not certain that the downward trends that we have seen continue, not because of what those countries do, but here mainly because of the situation in Southern African countries.
Thank you, Martin. Now I would like to come to my final question. I would like to come back to a topic that will be crucial for the development of Europe, crucial because Europe's growth and prosperity simply cannot be separated from this issue. I would like to talk about, as you call it, the quietly growing role of labor migration. Why is this topic so important, and what do you mean by the quietly growing role of labor migration?
I mean exactly what it says, A, that it's growing, and B, that it was not talked so much about last year. So other topics that you have mentioned before were more in the forefront and in the center of the public debate. However, the significance of labor migration is constantly growing. When we look at the certain categories, seasonal permits have increased more than 10 times since 2015, the year of the refugee crisis. Long-term residence permits for the purpose of work have, I think, almost tripled. Blue cards for researchers or students have increased significantly. And this trend continues and also continues during periods where there are where there's an economic cooling or even a downturn, as we might experience next year. And the reason for that is quite simple. It's a demographic one based on, in this case, rather precise forecasts. It is expected that the EU population in working age, so between 15 and 64 years, decreases by an average of 1.8 to 1.9 million every year for the next decade. So there's a structural demand for labor force. This structural demand cannot be covered by migration alone. Would be too many people we need, so it needs a more holistic strategy. But labor migration has to be part of it and is part of it already. And here the interesting aspect is that we have 27 EU member states and then many other European non-EU member states as well. And all of them follow their own labor migration policies. Labor migration is, contrary to other migration policy areas, largely in the sole responsibility of states, and it will stay like this politically. I think it's impossible to convince voters that the EU should have a much stronger role, a centralized role in this, wouldn't make too much sense either, because labor markets are very different when it comes to formal aspects. So it makes sense that those are national policies, but they create a very complex and fragmented environment. Our colleagues from the Migration Partnership Facility conducted a study, which is quoted in the Outlook, where they identified, I think, more, they described a bit less than 300, but I think they identified more than 300 different avenues to take up work legally in the EU for non-EU nationals. And that also implies a lot is happening, but it makes the situation, of course, not easier and not more transparent. Another topic that I also don't expect to be resolved in this year is the question how to go about essential but low-skilled or so-called low-skilled work that is largely covered by seasonal schemes. Also there, I don't expect a change, but also the economies, the enterprises, the industries are calling for also openings with regard to this segment. Again, not very likely to happen this year for political reasons, but this debate is there. So here, I don't expect 2025 to reduce the complexity and fragmentation I have mentioned. I hope that the initiatives that from bottom up try to help to better coordinate that, make that easier accessible, make that more transparent, find their support. And I hope also that our organization is part of this process.
Yeah, thank you very much for these impressive numbers, which describe a huge development of which the public didn't really take notice. And so this is somehow our role as ICMBD to describe not only what the public is talking about, but also which is simply relevant for migration and for migration policy. Thank you very much for this discussion today, Martin. Thank you for spending the holiday break again for the 8th time, I think, on drafting the ICMBD Migration Outlook. And thank you so much for providing us with all these important insights.
Thank you, Bernhard. And like every year, I hope I will be back again next year, and then we can discuss where we were right and where we were wrong. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to this. And today I was speaking about the ICMBD Migration Outlook 2025 with its lead author, Martin Hoffmann, principal advisor at ICMBD. I am Bernhard Schragel, ICMBD's head of corporate comms, and I look forward to welcoming you to the next ICMBD Migration podcast soon. For more insights and expert talks on migration, subscribe to our podcast and follow us on social media. Thank you for tuning in.